Good afternoon. It's Monday the 29th of October 2018, just after 1 o'clock. Welcome to UK Column News. I'm your host, Mike Robinson. Joining me today in the studio, Patrick Henningsen from 21st Century Wire. Welcome to the programme, Patrick.
Great to be with you, Mike.
Let's get straight on. And of course, today is Budget Day. Very important that today is Budget Day because it's happening before the next EU Brexit meeting. This was done because Theresa was panicking about whether the Democratic Unionist Party would try to sabotage the budget, because they threatened that if there was going to be some kind of hard border arrangement, some kind of customs union arrangement with regard to Brexit, that they would vote against the budget. And of course, that would leave Theresa in a very difficult position. So they've put a budget through. What did Mr. Hammond have to say about it? The Chancellor, he said, well, in the event of a no deal, we would need to look at a different strategy, and frankly, we'd need to have a new budget and set out a different strategy for the future. So basically, this budget is sort of an interim budget, a sort of in the meantime budget, before we know what's going to happen with Brexit budget, Patrick. And there is likely to be what people are describing as an emergency budget in the spring, once we understand where we stand with the European Union.
Well, I think we talked about this 2 weeks ago on the Sunday Wire, Mike, especially with regards to the Irish border issue. And from this announcement by Hammond, it seems to me, and also the sounds we're getting and signals in the press, Mike, that the die has been cast. In other words, the press, the public seem to be acclimated that there's going to be a no-deal budget, and therefore there will be a no-deal Brexit. Therefore, this is setting the stage, Mike, potentially for a second referendum. This is based on the signals that I've seen.
No, I completely agree.
Across all the papers.
Yeah, completely agree. Second referendum. And, you know, anybody that is in the slightest bit sort of on the fence about a second referendum, of course, what would the second referendum be? It would be a choice, it wouldn't be an in and out referendum like 2016. It would be a choice between Theresa May's deal or Remain. Yeah. And for many, many people, of course, that would be no choice at all.
Or a no-deal Brexit and Remain. That it could come down to that as well.
That I think they might get a surprise if they go that way and they say no deal or Remain. I think that they may get a surprise at the result of that, because I think there's quite a lot of people would be willing to accept a no deal. But anyway, we'll see. Let's move over to the United States, Patrick. And of course, the events towards the end of last week, beginning with the mail bomber.
Or faux mail bomber, Mike. So this is basically what dominated the U.S. news cycle just last week, starting from midweek. And this was the story of stories. Suspect packages sent to multiple Democratic Party figures, or mainly people associated with the Democratic Party, the Clintons, the Obamas, George Soros, Robert De Niro, et cetera, et cetera. And here's one of the suspect packages that turned up immediately. And of course, there's a lot of, it's more than suspect in terms of what it might contain, Mike. There's no postmarkings on any of these packages.
Does that actually mean it hasn't gone through U.S. mail?
Quite possibly, yes. So that's a question that people were starting to ask. And by the way, all of these were return addressed, marked from Debbie Wasserman Schultz. She's the disgraced former DNC acting head who went down a number of scandals. But the press seized upon this immediately as MAGA bomber was the hashtag. So it was, even before they knew who it was, the hashtag was already circulating that this was a Trump supporter targeting high-profile Democrats. As it turned out, Mike, the bombs were, as far as we can tell, inert. No initiators, no detonators, no timers. So they're not bombs, actually. They were hoax devices. By all accounts here, the law enforcement were very ambiguous with regards to whether there was any incendiary material in there. We're talking about explosives, not just flammable, but, you know, explosive material. So that led a lot of people to be very suspicious. But and what we were all asking on social media, Mike, was how long would it take for the press to claim that the Russians were behind this? And it only took about 24 hours before, well, this report came up. This is Chuck Todd from MSNBC with his panel of experts there, and couldn't help but fear that the Russians could be behind the faux mail bomb scare. So there's Chuck Todd with his experts there. Absolutely ridiculous. This is the conspiracy theory of all conspiracy theories, that the Russians were still looking for evidence that the Russians were meddling or somehow influenced or swung the U.S. 2016 election. But that means that speculation's just been rife. Anything has a Russian hand behind it with regards to the U.S. media. So that low point in mainstream journalism, that's fake news. And then the Washington Post came up with this one. This is interesting. So they went through his Facebook page. Cesar Sayoc, 56-year-old Trump supporter, ex-male stripper, interesting character, apparently living in his van with these beautiful decals in the windows. The mail bomb suspect made numerous references on social media to Russian associates and echoed pro-Kremlin views. So Russian associates means friends on Facebook, basically. And so they've tried to make a Russian plot out of comments he made in 2015. This 2015 is long before the media or anybody connected Trump and Russia, okay? So that's buying the buy, Mike. But if you go back real quick, I just want to point to the author of this, Craig Timberg. I saw that name and I thought, where do I know that name from? Craig Timberg, Washington Post. Who would come up with such a wild conspiracy theory? And then it just dawned on me, yes, Craig Timberg is the person who brought Proper Not into the mainstream via the Washington Post. And this is an anonymous list that was blacklist that was drawn up of 200 or so mainly U.S.-based websites that Craig Timberg accused of being part of some Russian web of propaganda. And if you just go back, I just want to point as well to, we did a story on this, Washington Post, sloppy journalism blames Russia for fake news crisis in Trump's win while pushing neo-McCarthyism. This was this push by the Washington Post was one of the original impetuses. This was the first beginning of the launch of the fake news campaign by the mainstream. And there's Craig Timberg, and there he is behind this latest wild conspiracy theory of a Russian plot behind Cesar Sayoc. So you can see this is a coordinated effort by the media. And these operatives or writers, journalists, whatever you want to call them, this is definitely a coordinated campaign to sort of generate talking points, none of which are based in fact, all based on speculation. And I would have to say, what else can you call it, Mike, but creative writing?
Creative writing. Incredible. Well, no sooner were questions beginning to be asked about the creative writing than the next event happened, which was in Pittsburgh. Horrific event, but nonetheless, the mainstream media, cynically, I think, have begun using that for other purposes, for political purposes.
Yeah, so the opportunists have taken hold of this story. Now, this is as opposed to the faux letter bomb campaign, this is actually, it looks like very much like a real tragedy involving a real gunman. And so this gentleman here, Mr. Robert Bowers, hardly a gentleman, armed to the tooth, walked into a synagogue, shot, killed 11 people, and also wounded law enforcement as well. And immediately, the speculation was that he was pro-Trump. Turns out that he's anti-Trump, Mike, from his posts. So I don't know exactly. So right-wing, anti-Trump, conspiracy theorist. And we'll talk a little bit more about the social media connection in a minute. Mm. But here's Haaretz. They didn't waste any time. Trump didn't pull the trigger on Jews in Pittsburgh, but he certainly prepped the shooter. This is just indicative of the sort of hysterical drive to sort of paint Trump somehow as driving anti-Semitism in America. And I have to say, and we'll remind everybody again, Trump is the most pro-Israeli, pro-Zionist president in living memory.
Just remind me, his son-in-law and his daughter are?
Jewish. Mm. Yeah, in living memory in the United States, I mean, there's never been anybody who's been in the pocket of Israel as much as Donald Trump. So the idea that Donald Trump is somehow driving anti-Semitism is laughable at best. He might be driving a lot of things, but he's not driving that, I can tell you right now, based on the facts. But that doesn't stop the wild speculation with going on. So this is interesting. So Hollywood celebrities have weighed in, and a whole new phenomenon has come out of this, Mike, that now the terms nationalist, globalist, and Soros are being connected with this shooter. And here's a Hollywood celebrity. I think she's meant to be a comedian or something. Her name is Sarah Silverman. She's got 12 million followers on Twitter. And this is what she came out with this great political jewel here. Dog whistle reminder to that these words used by our openly nationalist president are winks to the alt-right. Soros equals Jews. Globalist equals Jews, nationalist equals white nationalist. So there's Sarah Silverman, a Democratic Party activist, and they're basically leading her tribe as to maybe use these. These are now forbidden, or these words have been proscribed for use in general discourse because, well, a few people are making these connections. Ludicrous is an understatement, Mike. And the problem with this is, and we went into this in detail on the Sunday Wire, but so George Soros, attaching George Soros to the anti-Semitic trope, let's just look at, let's break this down. The shooter at the synagogue in Pittsburgh equates Soros with Jews. The mainstream media equates Soros with Jews. So the shooter is promoting an anti-Semitic line. The mainstream media is promoting the same anti-Semitic line. The reality is both the extremist shooter and the mainstream media, politicians as well, are actively promoting this anti-Semitic trope. Here's the reality. George Soros does not actively identify himself as a Jew, politically or religiously, nor has he ever been a practicing Jew. Here's the fact. George Soros is the arch enemy of Zionists, the Israeli state, and Benjamin Netanyahu. Go ahead and Google Netanyahu and Soros and look and just see how many articles come up with this fight between George Soros' Open Society umbrella, and mainly because Netanyahu and Israelis see Soros as a threat to the current apartheid system in Israel. That's a fact. So I just wanted to point that out. I know that might be a little bit complex for the Hollywood political activist tribe, but it's a fact. So we just thought we'd point that out to sort of clear up some of the confusion on that issue.
What's going on here? Muslims Unite for Pittsburgh Synagogue?
Well, this is an important little piece here that got missed by a lot of the media. Muslim groups got together, so far have raised, as of last night, $112,000 for the victims of the Pittsburgh synagogue shooting. Okay, why is this not on the front page of every newspaper? What this says to me, Mike, is the media and the political classes are very interested in sowing division. And they'll blame that on the Russians, of course, for sowing division in America. But the American establishment are doing quite a good job on their own of sowing division in their own country. Meanwhile, in the background, there are real people helping real people. There's Muslims raising money for Jewish victims, okay? So, and Christians for Jewish victims and so forth. So I know that goes against the anti-Semitic crisis narrative, but it's happening. So we thought we'd point that out. But I'll also point out, Mike, that unfortunately, this synagogue shooting happened at the very same time that Israel launched an incursion and airstrikes on Gaza. So, of course, the media will not criticize Israel because everybody seems to be in mourning from the Pittsburgh synagogue shooting. This is a political phenomenon, of course, which unfortunately has made its way into the media. But the BBC just sure didn't waste any time. The BBC ran a very deceptive headline. If you Google this story as well, what comes up in the Google cache is that Palestinian youths were killed while planting a bomb. Okay, and it doesn't make it clear that they were killed in an IDF airstrike, Mike. It's very deceptive, that headline by the BBC. So I think three Israeli youths killed. The IDF says, oh, we caught them planting a bomb. That's why we launched that airstrike and killed these three children. So who do you believe? Who do you believe in that situation? Well, the BBC have given the IDF the benefit of the doubt. And not only that, a very deceptive headline, Mike. Very disappointed with the BBC, although not surprised.
No, not surprised. So all this stuff around Trump at the moment coming up for the midterm elections. But what effect is it having? It's presenting the notion that there is a new right, a right building, a big, huge right, alt-right, whatever term you want to use, but the right wing is on its way.
A far-right movement.
Yes. Well, let's see what's been going on in the UK then. And here's the Daily Mail. The rape of justice, a girl 15 who was held as a sex slave by an Asian grooming gang and had a son conceived through rape, tells how social services took her child and then gave her her attacker a say in the boy's future. So this is a girl who was allegedly held captive, and she, as they say, became pregnant. She had a child. Social services got involved after she had apparently escaped from the grooming gang. They took the child away, and they're now have invited the father of the child, who's an alleged rapist, to come into court, they say, to perhaps see if they can't organise some contact for him and have he will have some say over what happens to this child. Now, this 15-year-old then became a sex slave, according to the Mail here, for 12 years. And the boy, the 5-year-old boy that they're fighting for, they say was conceived through rape, part of a pattern of assault, aggression, controlled behaviour and degrading verbal abuse, including constantly being demeaned as white trash, and she suffered at the hands of her abductors. Now, they're using, obviously, using a fake name for this girl, but they won't tell us which police service, which police region or was investigating this. They won't tell us which local authority, social services, were involved in this decision. They won't tell us which court this was heard in. I decided I would have a look at some of the comments, and there were quite a few similar to this. And it says, and the people exposing these crimes are put in jail and called far right for doing the right thing. It seems the PC Brigade are in charge of the asylum now and have the keys. Well, I think, Patrick, this is the problem. The person that they're referring to, of course, is Tommy Robinson. Mm-hmm. But Tommy Robinson is focusing on Muslim rape gangs. Now, these people, I don't care whether they're Muslim or Christian or whatever, anybody that commits rape has committed a crime. Mm-hmm. The police should investigate that, and criminal action should be taken in the courts under those circumstances. So what has Tommy Robinson actually been doing? He has been focusing on the Muslim rape gangs. Yes, they've committed a crime, and yes, they should be in prison for that. Nobody is denying what these people are doing. But the fact of the matter is that in parallel with Muslim rape gangs, there are white rape gangs. We look at what happened at Beechwood, and Melanie Shaw is a perfect example of that. If we look at this comment, the people that are highlighting this problem, no, the problem here isn't the Muslim rape gang. The problem here is the fact that the British justice system, British social services, didn't deal with these rape gangs in the first place, allowed them to get to a stage that they became really a massive problem in certain areas of the country.
But not just these ones, all of them. This is rife right across the country, Mike. And it's not a new phenomenon either. This is decades old.
Absolutely. So is the problem here the fact that these gangs exist? Or is the problem that the social services, the local authorities, the police aren't dealing with them, no matter what section of society they come from? And the problem here is that if this Mail article is to be believed, we have a justice system and a local authority and a police who are willing to see a rapist come into court and have some say over what happens to the future of a child. That's the issue that needs to be dealt with.
Mm-hmm. Instead of boiling it down to political identity,
correct,
or ethnic or racial division.
Once that issue is dealt with, Muslim rape gangs, church rape gangs, local authority rape gangs can no longer exist.
The crime in general.
The crime in general.
Sure.
Right.
Yeah.
So I'm going to say this article is designed to enrage. It's designed to push people towards the extremes. It's designed to push people in the direction of Tommy Robinson and the likes of Tommy Robinson. And I'm going to say that if you look at this and you look at what's been going on in the United States in the last week or so, we're seeing the same type of nudging behavior going on in an effort to move people towards the extremes. It's not just happening on the right, by the way. It's also happening on the left.
Absolutely.
I wonder what's going to happen in the not-too-distant future. I think we get a clue about that from comments from the likes of Tony Blair about a centrist party going to come along in the not-too-distant future. But in the meantime, we'll have extremism in all kinds, and as we'll see in a minute, that's permitting. In fact, well, we might as well just come straight onto it, because here's The Guardian saying MI5 to take over the fight against the rise of UK right-wing extremism. Right-wing extremism, according to that article, is now being put in the same category as Islamist extremism and Northern Irish terrorism. And so MI5 will take the lead in combating extreme right-wing terrorism amid mounting fears that white supremacists are increasing their efforts to foment violent racial conflict in Britain's streets. That's what this says. They're taking this over from the police. And Patrick, maybe I'm being too conspiratorial, maybe I'm being too cynical, but it seems to me that if what you want to do is to foment this type of extremism, then taking this, what they've said is that this is too serious a situation for the police to handle. So they take it into the security services, the domestic security services, where they can keep a much tighter rein on activities. If what they're aimed to do here is to foment right-wing extremism, they can keep a lid on those types of operations much easier if this is within the remit of MI5 rather than the police. And of course, you know, many would say they wouldn't do that.
Yeah, well, that's...
I think we've seen in the past that they have done that.
That article that you just showed from The Guardian, Mike, that reinforces the point that you just made previously. There is a clear agenda in the media to engineer, to build a far right and a far left movement right now. And I see this across every mainstream media publication. I see this on television. Politicians are also parroting these same talking points, Mike. So it seems, Mike, that there's some effort to really build up and construct both a far right and a far left, or what appears to be far right and far left movements, in order to have them clash, and then maybe, like you said, to offer something like some centrist solution down the road. So this is bad news for the next couple of years, Mike. It means that we're going to see a lot of tension if this indeed is what the establishment have planned for the rest of the population.
And let me just remind you from Friday's program, if you didn't see Friday's news program, please watch it. Mark Sedwill, National Security Advisor, he is the chief spook, has been made head of the civil service, a cabinet secretary. So he is therefore in charge of the Cabinet Office. We have provided evidence time and again of the unbelievable influence of the Cabinet Office on British affairs. The Cabinet Office is pulling Theresa May's strings at the moment. And of course, this is all part and parcel of the fusion doctrine, which we have mentioned many times. If you didn't see Friday's programme, please watch it and get a feel for exactly what infrastructure is being built within government. And it absolutely feeds into this picture of this far right movement, which is being built deliberately, in my opinion. And of course, another thing, Patrick, which is driving people towards the extremes, is the censorship agenda, which continues apace. And this now we have Gab, the sort of Twitter equivalent free speech social network, which has effectively been shut down. If you go to Gab's website, this is what you see. Gab.com is under attack. We've been systematically no platformed by app stores, multiple hosting providers, and several payment processors. We've been smeared by the mainstream media for defending free expression and individual liberty for all people. and for working with law enforcement to ensure that justice is served for the horrible atrocity committed in Pittsburgh. Gab will continue to fight for the fundamental human right to speak freely. I'm not saying that if you went to Gab before it was shut down, that you were going to find stuff on there that you're going to agree with 100% of the time. Of course you're not. But it all comes down to this issue. We might not like what people are saying, but we've got to defend the right to say it.
Because the Pittsburgh shooter was a Gab user, that's why this rapid shutdown attack has been made towards Gab, cutting off their payment, internet service capabilities, all of these contracts terminated, just because one of their users was involved in this shooting over the weekend, Mike. So, I mean, this... We're getting into really a slippery slope here. Mm. Is it any different than any other? What car was he driving to go to the shooting? What cell phone was he using? Who was he talking to? Should they shut the cell phone networks down as well? Should they listen to all our calls just in case anybody says anything extreme? That's where we're heading, Mike. With this level of digital tyranny, it's
becoming
shame.
Difficult to comment on this stuff.
It's a shame to see this, but this is where it's going. Not only that, my last comment, Mike, is by and Gilad Atzmon made this point on the Sunday Wire. You want to listen to that interview? I think there's a lot of really good points that we made by censoring people from Facebook and Twitter. And then forcing them onto platforms that are pro-free speech, that then creates a compartmentalization within society and within the discourse. And this is happening virtually on social networks. That's not a good thing in terms of debate, and in terms of discourse, and in terms of fleshing ideas out as a wider community. What it is, it can actually result in more extremism. On all fronts, left, right, and everything in between. But at the end of the day, that's not how we would want our discourse to be conducted in the physical realm, would it? Mm. If we're having a forum in the middle of town, having a town hall meeting, you want to have everybody at the same town hall meeting to work through these issues. You don't want people out in the fringes, out in the woods, having their own meetings. So if we are a democracy, if we do believe in the robustness of debate and the rigor of discourse, and we do have the intellectual minds who can mediate these sort of discussions, and people are mature enough to accept each other's differences of opinions, then we have to have this conversation together, Mike. Mm. We can't have it in walled-off gardens, because we know where that's going to lead. That a technocracy and tyranny will fester in that compartmentalized environment, and you're going to see more extremism. The state's going to clamp down even harder, and it's a very dark, Kafka-esque, dystopian future you're looking at there.
Okay, so on that note, let's remind everybody of Alternative View 9.1, Democracy in Chains, taking place on Sunday the 2nd of December in the Crown Plaza Hotel in Kensington in London. You're speaking at that, Dr. Graham Downing speaking at that, Brian Gerrish, Alex Thompson, and Ian Arkrin himself speaking. What are you going to be speaking about?
I'll be speaking about this issue that we're talking about right now, Mike. Mainly the collusion between big Silicon Valley corporations and government, which is corporatism, which is also, by definition, fascism. And that is it's antithetical to democratic principles, and especially in the United States, the principles of a constitutional republic, and I would think in this country as well. Principles adhering to a constitutional monarchy, even so. But at the end of the day, this catch-all term democracy is whatever your views are of democracy, Mike. That system is under threat, and it's under threat from within. And I believe it's big corporations colluding with big government is one of the biggest threats I think that society is facing. That's what we're going to talk about.
Okay, right. Now, this is Julian Lewis, who's on the Business, Energy and Industrial Strategy Committee in the House of Commons. And they're looking at the sort of mergers and acquisitions that are going on in defence at the moment. He's saying he's concerned that the intellectual property for a military project resides in a particular company, and if that company is broken up and sold off, we could end up with potentially hostile countries owning the intellectual property rights to our defense products. So they've been running calls for evidence, and they're going to be speaking about that during the week. Now, who's going to be giving evidence? Stuart Andrew, MP, who's Parliamentary Undersecretary of State and Minister for Defence Procurement. Richard Harrington, MP, Parliamentary Undersecretary of State and Minister for Business and Industry. Alex Chisholm, who's Permanent Secretary for Business, Energy and Industrial Strategy. And Hugh Walters, Director, Prosperity and International Business at the Ministry of Defence. Now, are they right to be concerned? Well, yes, indeed they are, because we're seeing huge levels of consolidation within the military-industrial complex at the moment. This is another massive merger on the US side for sure, but you know, British Aerospace playing in this market as well. So this is L3 and Harris agreeing to merge, creating a $33.5 billion military technology giant. And as we have highlighted on this program many times, a lot of the consolidation is happening at the European level as well. And we cited MBDA as an example of that, with British companies getting involved with French and Italian and Spanish and German companies to create these cartels or conglomerates in the defence industry. This is extremely dangerous, and I believe that, you know, while the Business, Energy and Industrial Strategy Committee is taking evidence on this, I don't see too much concern about this European level stuff that's going on at the moment. They're more concerned, I think, about maybe China buying up intellectual property, or Russia, or whatever. Perhaps it's the EU level stuff that needs to be looked at. So with that in mind, let me advertise another event, emergency briefing in defence and security, taking place this coming Saturday in Totnes. Do get along to that if you can. David Ellis will be speaking, as will Alex Thompson, Caroline Stevens and Brian Gerrish. Tickets are £5 on the door, if you could please, because there are some expenses in running this event. But we would particularly like help to promote this and promote it within Devon and Cornwall, I suppose, because there are quite a lot of retired military personnel in this area, and that's why it's being held here. So do get along to that if you possibly can. Now, NATO, good news, Patrick, because NATO is extremely happy to be celebrating Turkish Republic Day. Republic Day is today. And of course, in Turkey, if you're celebrating Republic Day, you'll be attending performances, participating in traditional processions with flags and music and so on. But NATO's pretty excited about this, and so they're highlighting this Turkish exercise that took place not long ago. They were also pushing out this little graphic today on Twitter and so on. Happy Republic Day, Turkey. Is it a happy Republic Day, Patrick?
Well, it looks like NATO's just trying to curry a little more favor with Ankara. So in terms of the Turkish Republic, well, that sort of seems to have already fallen by the wayside. I don't know if NATO got the memo, however, but President Erdogan effectively has suspended the country's constitution a year and a half ago, I guess. And, well, Mike, it's no longer a Kemalist republic. So I think the people at NATO might want to do a little more research.
Well, they might want to read this article.
Well, this is a very good article by Dr. Ken Arrington, who writes for 21st Century Wire exclusively, and he's a scholar on Eurasian and Turkish history and affairs. And he's written this, along with a number of other great articles. I think he's one of the best people on this topic. But the do-or-die moment happened, Mike, with Turkey, and effectively the Republic died. It's now transitioning to more of an Islamist-style state, Mike. So not to the level of Saudi Arabia, obviously. It's a monarchy. But in terms of what the West might call political Islam. Mm. So this is a Muslim Brotherhood-dominated political scene right now in Turkey. So, but nonetheless, I'm sure NATO's having a good time scuba diving.
Indeed. Well, they're not just scuba diving, but NATO's also have a good time with non-proliferation at the moment. And they have been producing all kinds of videos and so on. But last week, ambassadors at the North Atlantic Council were meeting on Thursday to discuss the Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces Treaty. with participation from senior officials from the United States. Now, the question I'm going to ask you, Patrick, is do you think they were concerned about Trump's abandoning the INF treaty? No, they weren't. No, apparently they were particularly concerned about Russian missile system called the 9M729 or SSC-8. And so that meeting was an opportunity for allies to share views on the INF treaty and to assess the implications of Russia's destabilizing behavior on our security. So there you go. What do you make of that?
I love these propaganda videos that they do. They've spent a lot of money shooting them. Very dramatic, Mike. NATO is doing exactly the thing that the Western Bloc countries tried to avoid, especially Europe tried to avoid throughout the whole Cold War, which was use Europe as cannon fodder or as a battleground between the USSR and the United States. And that's exactly the way it's being set up right now. And I'm just waiting for the penny to drop, Mike, that there might be some political leaders in Europe that might say, hey, United States, this isn't really in our best interest. We don't want to be cannon fodder in a geopolitical chess match between the United States and Russia for whatever regional or Eurasian hegemonic dominance. We want out, basically. We're going to recognize Crimea. The Ukraine will eventually have some bilateral relations, healthy relations with Russia, and so forth. So that's going to actually happen at some point, Mike. Mm. But I think what you're seeing now is the military-industrial complex, the government media complex are trying really hard to cash in the next couple of years, because eventually that penny will drop, because it is not in Western Europe, or Eastern Europe, or Europe full stop. It's not in their interest to have an adversarial relationship with Russia, nor is it in Russia's interest. What's in both of their interest is healthy trade and tourism together. I think everybody can agree on that. But as those companies that you showed earlier, Mike, these defense contractors, that's not good for them. They want to sell bombs, missile systems, F-35 planes that can't fly, and other big ticket items, because that's a whole industry in itself. And NATO is functioning as some sort of protection racket front for that industry. And so I think eventually, Mike, it's going to be, well, I don't think you can stop the eventuality of it. But there are hawks in Washington and London, especially, that will do anything to maintain the status quo right now, which is a high level of tension.
Yeah, well, just to finish that off then, there is actually a big conference going on in Iceland today. It's the 14th annual NATO conference on weapons of mass destruction, arms control, disarmament, and non-proliferation. That's obviously happening at the moment. We'll have a look at that and see if there's anything interesting going on later on, and no doubt we'll talk about that on Wednesday a little bit. But now, just briefly on this one, Patrick, if we could, because there's been elections taking place in Brazil.
Sure. Well, Bolsonaro won by a landslide. This was the nightmare for everybody. This is Brazil's Trump, as he's being marketed. He actually makes Donald Trump look like a bit of a schoolboy. But if you go back to this article there, that was tweeted out by Andrew Fishman from The Intercept, I believe. So he's basically, this is the end of the world, a sad day for Brazil and the world. Bolsonaro is elected president of Brazil. Read his extremist far-right positions in his own words. So he won by a landslide. So my question to this author was, okay, whatever your political position is, the majority or the large majority of Brazilians voted for, does that mean a large number of Brazilians are far-right extremists, those voters who voted for this president? And normally the answer you get from the typical left, I would say, or what so-called left, will say, well, the voters just aren't smart enough. They're ill-informed voters, and they were led astray by this fascist personality. That level of contempt for working class voters is the very thing why people, you know, why left candidates are losing in some of these elections, because they do hold the large portion of the working class voters in contempt. So I think the solution is you need to re-engage with these people and talk to these people, find out what the issues are, because clearly one side managed to identify what some of these issues are, and they're not just fascist rhetoric. They have to do with corruption in government, have to do with the economy, security, unemployment. These are all important issues too. But it seems that some parties and some political sides of this paradigm are more concerned with other things, like, for instance, political identity. So if you want to hang your whole campaign platform on political identity issues, you might lose a large section of voters. So we're not advocating for any side, left or right, but we're just saying this is the dynamics of the current political environment. Look at, this is how Donald Trump got elected. So this is happening in other, this isn't just confined to the United States. So people need to, on both sides of the political paradigm, need to get real and look at what our issues are affecting people instead of just looking after the interests of corporations, lobbyists, and the people who are financing your campaigns, and mainstream media who are giving you the platform to push whatever that corporatist agenda is. Because you're losing touch with the people on the ground, this is why the election results are going this way. So,
okay, let's end off then with Mr. Khashoggi, getting back to Turkey for a second. So this is a bit of a bombshell, according to the Express. Khashoggi bombshelled Britain knew of kidnap plot and begged Saudi Arabia to abort plans. Really?
Isn't that an exciting headline, Mike, by the Express? Did that not grab you? And does it not grab everybody? So who's the source for this? Well, it's a secret intercept from GCHQ. So we'd all love to believe this headline, Mike. This is the headline we'd love to believe, which is that Khashoggi was killed because he was about to blow the whistle on Saudi chemical weapons use in Yemen. And you're thinking, wow, this is brilliant. We love this. But here we go and dig in a little deeper, and we find this quote, and we see the ambiguity which has been set up in this article. The orders, intelligence sources say, did not emanate directly from the de facto ruler, Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, and is not known if he was aware of them. So they set the story up to look like it was the Crown Prince gave the order in order to cover up chemical weapons use. You look down this article, Mike, on the Express, there is not, in the body of the article by Marco Gianangeli, there's not one mention of chemical weapons. Can you believe it? So they set up this brilliant plot in the headline and the subheader, and there's nothing in the body of the article about chemical weapons. So it leaves me, the reader, thinking, well, you know, what is there anything to this story, or is this a planted story? And it just so happens, this is the same Express writer, Marco Gianangeli, who pushed this story out for the Express earlier this year, I believe, in I think it was April. This was right at the height of the Duma chemical weapons thing, and after Skripal, basically saying that RAF signals intelligence intercepted a secret transmission from Syria that they heard the package has been delivered or something like this. And so that's meant to be the Russians were talking to the Syrians, the Skripal Novichok package was delivered, and this was GCHQ came and said, well done, boys. Alex Younger made a big announcement. This was in the Express, same author, Marco Gianangeli. But this story was debunked in the Cyprus Mail, and I believe even Alex Thompson, who's an analyst for the UK column, weighed in on this story and basically explained you know, point by point why this is highly unlikely and why this is, you know, not really a credible scenario. And the message, the Express said, included the phrase, the package had been delivered. And this, they say that this, as well as an earlier intercept, formed the key part of British intelligence evidence against Russia over the Skripal poisoning. They told the Express, where is this evidence, Mike?
It doesn't exist, Patrick.
So we have a repeat. They've done it again yesterday. So do you believe that Khashoggi story? Let us know in the chat box if you think that's a viable scenario there, or if that is just fake news. I think it sounds like a deflection. To deflect from what? Well, we'll find out soon enough.
Well, one of the issues over the whole Khashoggi thing in Saudi Arabia over the last few days has been the question of business relations with the kingdom. Well, here is John Flint, who has made a statement. He's, of course, head of HSBC. He said, I understand the emotion around the Khashoggi story, but it's very difficult to think about disengaging from Saudi Arabia, given its importance in global energy markets. And so, you know, he decided that he would not personally attend the big trade and finance conference last week in Saudi, but somebody else from HSBC went instead. So the HSBC absolutely was represented. This statement implies that he felt that he couldn't go, but certainly didn't want to do away with the business, so they had to be represented in some way. But this, of course, is part of the problem here, Patrick, because Saudi Arabia is right at the heart of energy supply for so many countries and so many businesses. It's pretty difficult for them to take any kind of stand on this, even if they wanted to, which I don't believe that they do.
It's incredible. So that was just a very deft PR move, announcing that the boss won't be attending, and that captures the headline. Meanwhile, they do send a lower level emissary to Davos in the desert, Mike. But it just seems to me amazing that there's even talk about divestment and sanctions against Saudi Arabia over I'm going to say, Mike, where's the body of Jamal Khashoggi? Has any evidence been produced yet? We're still waiting. We're told it's there or it's somewhere. But all this talk just because of one person who effectively was a Saudi insider. And if you think about what Israel has been prosecuting against the Palestinians just in the last year, with I don't know how many hundreds of people killed unarmed, and there's no talk of any, at a government level anyway, of any divestment or any sanctions or cutting off diplomatic ties or anything like that with the state of Israel. It's incredible. Nor was that any of this outrage for Saudi's the carnage that Saudi Arabia unleashed in Yemen for the last 3.5 years, using U.S. and U.K. military product and French too and Spanish, but mainly U.S. and U.K. are the two biggest vendors to Saudi Arabia to prosecute that illegal war of aggression based on the Nuremberg principles against their neighbor. No calls for divestment or sanctions or anything. And all of a sudden, this one incident happens, and that somehow the talk circulates. But is it all talk, Mike? Will there be any action?
There won't be any action. And I firmly believe, Patrick mentioned this on your program recently, the way that this is being presented, not the event itself, but the way that it's being presented in the mainstream media with these kinds of comments from business people, and the way that it's being shown in the press, the parallels with the Skripal affair are clear. Not in the event itself, but in how it's being presented. And of course, many people found it difficult to accept the Skripal affair because there was no evidence behind it. But of course, people tend to be, or many people are, a lot more or a lot less aggressive towards Russia, perhaps, than they are towards Saudi Arabia. A lot of people are pretty anti-Saudi Arabia. And so they're perhaps more likely to be willing to accept this story as it stands, with this Khashoggi story as it stands at the moment. And of course, if they do accept that story without requiring the evidence of a body and the other evidence that is claimed by the intelligence services, but of course we're not allowed to get access to, if they're prepared to accept that story on this side, then where does that leave them with regard to the Skripal story? So we've got to somehow say that we are going to maintain the same standard of evidence requirement, no matter who the alleged perpetrator is, whether we like them or not, it doesn't matter. We've got to maintain the same requirement for evidence. Otherwise, we're capitulating to Theresa May's rapid response mechanism and the need, we don't need evidence anymore.
It's trial by media.
But absolutely.
Just quickly, I want to break ranks. Go back to that Express headline real quick, this one. Look, so Britain warned Saudi in advance, Mike. So if you believe this story, that Britain knew in advance and they tried, they begged the Saudis, please, please don't kill Khashoggi. Please don't kill Khashoggi, right? So they're nudging you back towards trusting the British side of the story, because Britain had lost all credibility with the Skripal affair. So this is not, I believe that this Express story is nudging. I think that's one of the main functions of this story, is to nudge people back to the direction of trusting the British government a little bit more, that they are behind the scenes, they are white hats, and they're wanting to, you know, do the right thing and save lives, etc. And I don't doubt that that's the case, on many fronts, but we're talking specifically about the Skripal affair and the Khashoggi affair and the media coverage and also this interesting relationship between the secret intelligence services and the press.
I think you're being too kind to them. But anyway, look, we'll have to leave it there because we're well over time. Thank you very much for joining us today, Patrick. Thank you for joining us. If you like what we're doing and you'd like to see us keep doing it, please consider taking out a subscription or making a donation. It's up to you. And we will be back at the same time on Wednesday as usual. And we'll see you at 1 o'clock. Hope to see you then. Bye-bye.